أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على خير خلقه وخاتم أنبيائه ورسله سيدنا وشفينا بالقاسم محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المنتجبين رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي أما بعد فقد قال سبحانه وتعالى في كتابه المجيد وهو أصدق القائلين بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا أيها الناس إنا خلقناكم من ذكر وأنثى وجعلناكم شعوبا وكبائل لتعارفوا إن أكرمكم عند الله أتقاكم إن الله عليم خبير صلوات. First, I want to thank you for extending to me this gracious invitation to be with you to commemorate the historical events that have been etched in our historical memories and that have been imprinted in our psyche. Muharram is an occasion that brings about, it enlivens our human conscience. And therefore, it is always a pleasure and a privilege to be with this community whose collective intelligence is much higher than mine and many other places. So it is a pleasure to be here. I also want to congratulate the way the program and the sequence of events followed. I think it's marvelous. You know, the person who recited the Noha, the one who read Dua Kumail, the person who read the narrative, the historical narrative, and he took us quickly. We covered quite a bit of ground from 680 AD up to the departure all the way to Mecca. Normally a Maulana would take 3-4 days for this. But anyways, you know, we try to stretch it and get maximum mileage out of it. Anyways, I think it's very good. And we had, what else did we have? That's basically it. And a nice introduction by Brother Muhammad. Thank you very much. I really appreciate this. Salawat. We inaugurate the beginning of the Islamic year with a sense of reverence, respect, admiration for the Shuhada of Karbala. At the same time, it is coupled with a sense of heavy responsibility, a moral, ethical responsibility, that we have to seek out the ideals for which Imam Hussein sacrificed his life and the lives of his family members and companions and the families, that we hold this moral responsibility to make sure that we live our lives in accordance with the ideals that he stood for, both at the individual level and also at the level of society. The Arabic term for the person who is a martyr, we say, is shaheed. Etymologically, it means to witness. A person who testifies in the court of law, we use the same verb. The Shuhada of Karbala are testimony, or they testify, and they are witnesses to the universal ideals that has no boundaries of religion, no boundaries of geographical boundaries, no ethnicity, no culture, no gender. And those are the universal ideals, thank you, universal ideals of justice, adala, the universal ideals of truth, al-haq, the universal ideal of love. It's very, very important. I think we forget at times. Love played a very important, crucial role, mahabba, in the historical narrative of Karbala. It is permeated with love. Surprisingly, religion is all about hatred. If you look around in the media, we see the kind of events that are unfolding in the Muslim world and around the world in general. We are creating cultures of hate. It's really phenomenal. A religion whose foundation is based upon love has now been exploited to use as a tool for creating hate, animosity, hostility, bloodshed. It's truly remarkable. It's a complete reversal of the essential message of Imam Hussein and the essential message of the Prophet. We use the Muharram program not to create cultures of love, but rather we use the Muharram program to create cultures of animosity and develop what we call sectarian mentality. You know, we become sectarian, even more so. We reinforce our sectarian identity that I am a Shia and I am opposed to all that Sunni represents, and vice versa. This is precisely how we have come to developing this what we call intra-Muslim hatred, Sunni and Shia. Of course we can have disagreements. Of course we can have historical disagreements. Our historical narrative, our historical recollection could be different than the historical recollection of the Sunnis. Our doctrinal understanding of our doctrines can be different than the doctrines of the Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah. But it does not give us any room to begin the process of putting the seeds of animosity and hatred. Like I said, one of the ideals for which they testify, the Shuhada, they testify to the enormous love that was prevalent in the Karbala episode. They represent the ideals of devotion, loyalty. You know, we saw Imam Hussein as he was journeying from Medina and he goes to Mecca. And he keeps on informing the people, listen, he doesn't hide any of the information that is being revealed to him, that is unfolding in his as he's progressing. Somebody who is a politician, he tries to hide all the negative information because you don't want people to leave you. If Imam Hussein's mission was political in nature, to overthrow the regime of the Umayyad, well, it's a tactical mistake, a big strategic mistake, to tell your followers that, listen, things are happening that are not going the way we were anticipating in Kufa. He tells them everything throughout the journey. Until the last eve of Ashura, he tells them, tomorrow is the last day. Make up your mind. This shows that Imam Hussein's mission is quite different than seeking out political power. This is power dynamics is something different than the mission. His mission was far more grander. And this is the grandeur of Imam Hussein, that after more than 13 centuries, his mission remains alive. And the longevity, the eternality of his mission shows us that this is truly a miraculous achievement, that he was not seeking military accomplishment. Military accomplishments would have been gotten and forgotten as easily. Imam Hussein is seeking out at the core of human conscience. Imam Hussein is talking to our human conscience, our fitra, and he's talking to universal ideals, the universal values of justice, of truth, of love, of devotion, of faith, and also of endurance, patience, perseverance. There are difficulties in life. The test of one's iman comes when we are in our worst moments. You have to know how the husband behaves or the wife behaves when you are tested. Well, if everything is fine, hunky-dory, and you have lots of money, I don't know, economy is good. Economy is very bad these days. I don't know how much, you know, anger we have nowadays going on. But the test is when you are in a state of difficulty. In those trying moments, we see the lesson of patience and endurance. You know, the Quran says when things are going well, people remember God. When things are not going their way, this is when they begin to complain to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Salawat. So it's a remarkable commemoration of the events. And my focus will remain on try to emphasize the universal core. I am not interested in creating sectarianism. That's not my objective. Like I said, we want to create cultures of love. We want to create cultures of harmony and mutual respect. We want to create cultures of mutual enrichment. We want to create what the Quran calls the culture of ta'arafu, lita'arafu. The Quran says we have made you into different nations and tribes, so that you will begin to appreciate each other mutually. Lita'arafu. Ta'arafu is a reciprocal verb in Arabic. There is reciprocity. There is a give and a take. It is not a one-way street. Ta'arafu means there's a mutual benefit from both sides. It's a mutual enhancement, mutual enrichment. It's a very, very beautiful Quranic verse. The diversity of races, diversity of cultures, diversity of tribes and nations has a divine purpose. And the divine purpose is to enhance our mutual appreciation of each other, not to create mutual animosity. Differences are to be celebrated. In the Quran, differences are not frowned upon. Differences are part and parcel of being a human being. All of us cannot be the same. All of us cannot think the same. All of us cannot be monolithic. If everybody was a clone, the world would be a very boring place. Don't you agree? We need to have differences at times. Of course, we respect each other's opinions. But this is the way we progress. And inshallah wa ta'ala, this is the culture that I want to inculcate inshallah wa ta'ala in our majalises of the 10 nights, is that we are engaged in a dialogue, in a dialogical understanding of how our tradition rests. Salawat. And before I proceed, there's an interesting point I want to bring to your attention. Is that I came here probably a decade ago, and I'm truly privileged to be back. But you know, 10 years ago when I came, there was no member. And 10 years hence, there is no member. Now I know that you are not running short on funds, because I know all of you are very wealthy. Money is not the issue. I'm trying to understand the wisdom and the rationale as to why you have deliberately avoided giving a member. Is there a reason? I'm just curious, really. I know that money is not the issue. Is there a rationale? No? Sorry? Who should I ask? Oh, there is one over there. So you deliberately took it away from me, that means. Ah, okay, I didn't see that. So when the program is for both genders, you keep the member there? That's how it is? Or if somebody has a turban, you give him the member? I mean, is there some discrimination going on here? I'm just trying to figure out. Okay? But I think it's a good custom to some extent. You know why? Because many of the spatial configuration that we see in a mosque or synagogues or churches, the configuration of the mosque and the podium establishes a power differential. It establishes a power relationship. The higher the member, the more authority I have. Isn't it true? You are developing a relationship. Implicitly, even subconsciously maybe. Maybe that's not your intention. But when I sit on a chair, I don't feel as authoritative as I would feel if I was sitting on the third floor there. It's natural. It's human nature. Elevation in plateau develops a sense of authority. A sense that I am the one who should be delivering the authentic message and you should be absorbing like a sponge. That's how it is. It's a monologue. But when you put me on a chair, I get a feeling that no, it's more like a dialogue. It's supposed to be an exchange. You know, we have two kinds of pedagogy of teaching. One is known as the pedagogy of, I call it SpongeBob, because my son loves SpongeBob. Do you get SpongeBob here, by the way? No? I call the pedagogy of SpongeBob, and scholars call it the pedagogy of what they call the banking system. In this pedagogy, what you do is there's a one-way street in which the professor teaches the students and they learn how to just absorb it. There is no analysis, there is no critical thinking, there is nothing. They just absorb it, one-way street, and they are just waiting for the exam time to come so they can again regurgitate and parrot what I have told them. This is known as the pedagogy of a SpongeBob. Whatever I give you, you just throw it back and you get a good grade and ma salama khudafiz, and he's happy or she's happy. There's also another pedagogy. The pedagogy of developing what we call learning communities. That is to say that there's a learning and listening going on both, learning and teaching on both sides. Not that I'm the one authoritative to give you only, I'm the one who's supposed to teach you, but rather we create communities that are also learned. It's very, very critical. for religion to function as a viable dynamic phenomena and not to be hijacked, for religion not to be hijacked by those who claim to be authoritative. You know what is going on, let's say by Al-Qaeda, what is happening by the Wahhabi culture. It is precisely because they emphasize the phenomena of don't use your intellect, don't use thinking power. Listen to what we say, we are the authorities, we know what God wants, we are the literalist readers of the Quran, we can only read the Quran, not you. This pedagogy is a hazard, is a distinct danger. And we see this happening in our world. Why do you think someone like Major Hassan, you all know about Fort Hood in the United States, a Muslim who proclaims the name of God, Allahu Akbar, the same God who is compassionate, the same God who is infinitely kind, the same God who is a just God. And he proclaims this name of God, and we said the name of this Allahu Akbar at least 100 times in the 5 daily prayers. Isn't it true? And he has the audacity to defile and to corrupt this name of God by shooting down people. Unconscionable. Don't you think? There's something wrong. There's a disconnect somewhere between killing innocent people by proclaiming the word of God, the same God that we remember as the person who is, as the divine who is just. Don't you see some kind of a disjuncture? There's some kind of a disconnect somewhere in his understanding of religion. He is not just a psychopath. I don't believe that, you know, his fuse went out and somehow on that moment of insanity, he somehow began this unconscionable act of wreaking havoc. At least this is not my understanding of what happened. You can of course disagree. My reading is it was a conscious decision that he had made. A person does not lose his fuse overnight. His mindset was prepared to engage in that kind of demagoguery. He was prepared. He was prepared because he was pummeled with hate. All that was within him was full of hate and anger and despair and hopelessness, despondency. When you create that kind of a culture of hopelessness and hate, you have this reaction. If you create the culture of Imam Hussein, it's impossible to commit this kind of heinous crimes. No matter how much you may be angered, there is this sensibility of fairness and equity and justice. You will see throughout the Karbala episode, Imam Hussein never took the initiative to be the aggressor. At every moment he was preaching restraint. He was giving them sermons that, listen, we can prevent this shedding of blood. And here we have somebody who has no qualms and he wants to create maximum casualty. Maximum casualty. What we see right now happening in Peshawar, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Iraq. One wonders what has happened to this beautiful religion of Islam that is being mutilated day in, day out. It's being mutilated by the outsiders, by Daniel Pipes and Horvitz and company. And also it is being harmed by our own brothers and sisters. It's a very sad situation that we are currently embroiled in, to try to understand the phenomena of what Islam means at the essence, and not Islam in terms of just rituals and narratives. Salawat. Why do I say it's not just a psychopath? It's something that has to do with, because he said the name of God. He felt he has some kind of religious validation. Isn't it true? He thinks he has religious legitimacy to do that. How is it possible to imagine that while somebody is praying Friday prayers in a mosque, somebody can throw a grenade in the name of God? It's really baffling, isn't it? And this is not just Islam, by the way. In Judaism, we have examples. In Christianity, we have examples. Also in secular culture we have examples. Secularism can also be very fanatic. What we do in the name of secularism is also equally exclusivistic. What we are doing, for example, in Switzerland, you can't have minarets. This is fundamentalism. We say, for example, in France, you can't wear hijab. It's an example of fanaticism. It's secular fanaticism. It's not just religious phenomena. Even non-religious phenomena can be equally extremist. You can't do things in Turkey. It's again a phenomena of being a fanatic. So it's not just in religion, but there is something that is happening in our present day world, which is so scary, I believe. It is so frightening that if we don't correct our compass, you know, we are losing our moral compass. You know, we had a sense of right and wrong. Imam Hussein was supposed to be our boundary, our compass. That this is right, this is wrong. This is just, this is unjust. We are losing our sense of moral orientation. And that's why we do these things. You know, that's why we do these things in the name of religion. He, I believe, had a conscious effort, conscious decision, intentionally to create casualty. For example, they said, you know why? It's because they were forcing him to go to Iraq. And he was torn, morally torn, between killing his own fellow brothers and sisters, or killing here and, you know, getting over with. It's not true. It's not true. It's just an excuse. He was a psychiatrist, wasn't he? He's supposed to be not on the war fronts. He's supposed to be treating people, right? If you look at the way he was dressing, in all the clips they were showing, the morning where he went to buy his coffee and whatever in those clips, you will see that the attire, the dress code that he's wearing, the clothing, is not the clothing of an Arab. What is he wearing? Anyone know? In that clip that you must have seen 100 times, what was he wearing? He wasn't wearing the Arab dishdashi. He was wearing what? Sorry? Oh, you didn't see the clip. Oh, you see, this is United States then, you know, CNN. You don't get CNN? It was repeated, you won't believe, I'm not exaggerating, tens and hundreds of times on television, that the morning in which he had gone to a grocery store to buy his cup of coffee or whatever and his donuts or whatever he had, or muffin, and this clip was captured by the store owner. They have the security cameras. And then this clip was given to the media outlets, and they showed this, that he is so calm. And he's wearing the clothing of, he's wearing shalwar kameez. He's wearing the kind of attire that you would see, for example, in Afghanistan. That shows that he had some kind of a mindset in which he was sharing the ideology of those who are the extremists in Afghanistan. Otherwise, an Arab would never wear this dress. The Arab culture has a sense of muruwa, nobility, tribalism. They don't believe they need to follow any other culture because the Arabs have this sense of superiority of tribal lineage, tribal humanism, muruwa, asabiyya. And therefore, for an Arab to wear shalwar kameez is indicative of his mental orientation. He was in affiliation, at least he was loyal, and he was devoted to the ideology of extremism, to exclude people, where life has no value. You can kill. If you feel that somebody has been unjust to you, you have a license, they feel, to kill. To kill Muslims, to kill non-Muslims, to kill whoever you like, because somebody has wronged you. This is antithesis. It goes diametrically opposed to all that Imam Hussein stood for. Absolutely diametrically opposed. Because somebody has been unjust to you, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salatu afdhalu salam, peace be upon him. You don't think he could have taken revenge? He could have taken revenge very easily. When he was not given the khilafah, when he was not given the political mandate, he could have created havoc, a bloodshed. You have taken away my rights. You don't think the Prophet could have created bloodshed when he reconquered Mecca? Of course, people had persecuted him, people had harassed him, people had tortured him. He could have created bloodshed if he liked. Rather, he said, I liberate all of you. A different culture of Islam that we have and what we are seeing being unfolded today in the Muslim world and all over the world, I think, in the secular culture as well. In any event, I don't want to apologize for Major Hassan. I don't think we as Muslims need to apologize, or Islam has to apologize, for the criminality of somebody else. Just like if somebody does something wrong in Christianity or Judaism or in secular culture. You know, the secular culture has invaded Afghanistan. We as Muslims, I think, need to offer no apology. It's an act of criminality. It's an act that is a heinous crime. But we do not claim it is part and parcel of the religious ideology of our core values, and therefore no apology is required. It's an act of a fanatic. And we can find fanatics in all kinds of religions, all kinds of secular culture. What we need to take ownership of, I believe, not to apologize, but to take ownership that in our medieval literature, we have literature that talks about warfare in these kinds of terms, what we're seeing today. If you pick up some of the books, juridical books, literature, of medieval scholars, medieval jurists, you will find this notion of expansionists of the Islamic empire. Darul Islam, Darul Harb. You have the abode of Islam, and you must expand the abode of Islam to conquer the abode of either abode of Kufr or the abode of Harb, where there is war. This mentality, mindset of expansionist mentality, conversion mentality, that I can convert you by force. We have this, not in the Quran, by the way, not in the Hadith. The Quran is very much inclusive about religions. The Quran is very accommodating about different ideas. But our literature in the medieval times, especially Sunni literature, is very antagonistic, very exclusivistic, and very inimical, hostile. And therefore, somebody who believes in this ideology of Major Hassan and Al-Qaeda, it's very easy to find books. I can bring for you books and books and books and show you the literature of hate in our literature we have. Look at Ibn Rushd, a great scholar. Look at some of his books on jihad. Full of blood. Blood mentality. Therefore, we need to take ownership to say, listen, these kinds of literature that we have in our history, our historical legacy, although it has been written by Muslim scholars, we owe no loyalty to these kinds of garbage. They can be good scholars in many other respects, but these kinds of things that they have written, they should be thrown away in the dustbin of history. And we should say this openly, that we throw them in the dustbin of history. We have no relation with them because they conflict with the Quran. Whatever agrees with the Quran, we embrace. Whatever agrees with the Sunnah and the Hadith or the Prophet and the Imams, we accept. Whatever collides with it, says the Hadith, throw it against the wall. Just strike it against. We don't need to apologize for the writings of Muslim scholars who have preached hate. Don't you agree? Why should I apologize? My Islam is being damaged. And don't I have a right to say, listen, it's not my Islam. It has to do with this garbage scholarship. Not that they are garbage, the scholars are good. But this particular scholarship is garbage. Scholars can write golden things, at the same time scholars can make mistakes. They are not ma'asum. Don't you agree? The only ma'asum are the Prophet, Fatimah al-Zahra, 14, right? I mean, we can't give isma to everybody, right? So if there is no infallibility, then of course they are human beings, they make mistakes. And then also, they say Allahul Alam, that means God knows best, I can err. And therefore these kinds of things, we must tell the public that we dissociate from this kind of literature. We disown this. Our Quran never speaks that language of hate. The Hadith does not speak the language of hate. The kind of hate we see coming out is being taken selectively from this kind of literature. And we have lots, by the way. We have lots of literature that talks about hate. but not the Islamic literature. It is the literature produced by Muslim scholarship. So you have to distinguish Muslim scholarship and Islam. They are not identical. Right? Muslims can make mistake. Islam, the ideal, is something quite different. And we need to be loyal to Islam and not to our Muslim scholarship. Salawat. Imam Hussein's message of universality. We say, how come we remember Imam Hussein perpetually? The secret is because he stood for values that transcend history. Imam Hussein's values cannot be limited by a particular century, by a particular region, by a particular religion. Even non-Muslims praise Imam Hussein. That means that the secret of his eternality, perpetuality of his message, the longevity is because he stood for values that are eternal values. Justice is justice, not prepared to compromise. Truth is truth. Love is not open for compromise for hate. Devotion is not compromise for betrayal. You can't betray. Imam Hussein was a person of love and devotion, loyalty. Imam Hussein was the lesson of patience and perseverance and endurance. And we have the same lessons today of patience and perseverance. They are not open for compromise. They are not time bound. They are not context bound. And they are not bound by region. And this is why, no matter how many years pass, Imam Hussein's message remains as fresh as the 7th century in the Karbala scorching heat. The Quran remains relevant for us because the Quran speaks a language of universality. And this is where I want to emphasize is this particular core. The core is our focus in these lectures. The core apparently can also become distorted. With time, as time progresses, the core essential values can become rusted. They can become adulterated. It's normal. It's very normal. If after 50 years of the Prophet's death, the Prophet died in the year, which year he died? 6. Yeah, you can say it. Sisters know it all the time. I know sisters are more brighter than boys, by the way. I know that. So 632. And Karbala took place, said Brother Asaria, in 6. No. 660 is when Imam Ali took the Khilafah. You know, he died in 661. 656 to 6. Okay, who was listening to Brother Asaria? Nobody? He gave such a beautiful talk. He wasn't listening to himself even. Any guesses? I give you 3 lifelines. Okay, I know you know it, but if you are shy, 680. No, you can't cheat. He's looking at his paper now. 680. How many years between the Prophet's death and the Karbala episode? Yeah, half a century, let's say. If within half a century, Islam can regress so quickly that they can shed the blood of the grandson of the Holy Prophet, you don't think that after 13 centuries, Islam needs some kind of re-examination? It's only normal. This is nothing to be surprised about, or nothing to be shocked. It is part and parcel of remaining fresh. If Islam is going to remain fresh, we have to constantly re-evaluate, reassess. The same thing we can argue has happened to perhaps the Karbala episode. And this is why the title of my talk was, the theme of my talk is, that there is what we call exaggeration, there's also extremism, and there's also fanaticism. What do I mean? In Arabic, extremism means ghuluv. In the Quran, for example, it says to Ahlul Kitab, Ya Ahlul Kitab, La taghlu fi dinikum. O people of the scripture, do not engage in exaggeration. What does it mean? It means do not elevate the status of Prophet Jesus above his actual status of being a mortal. Don't elevate him to divinity. لا تغلو. Whenever you take somebody and exceed the boundaries of where he or she ought to be, we say it is ghuluv. Ghuluv always operates in the direction of positive. It is not when you try to devalue somebody. We don't say ghuluv. We say tafrit. So ghuluv is, for example, an example of ghuluv is, and I, by the way, I have, this is a good time for me to market my book, my translation of a book. Time passes by so fast, and I want to have time for questions. A book on ghuluv, written by Ayatollah Salehi Najaf Abadi, a great scholar who has a number of good works, and I did the translation from Persian to English. It's a small booklet. It's about maybe 150 or 180 pages or so. It's a very, very good book on how, with the passage of time, some of the people around the imams, they try to elevate their status to become a deity, a god. This is known as ghuluf. For example, to say that the imam shares in the divinity, in the attributes of God. And they would say the Imam Ali is God and we are supposed to be his messengers. For example, Abu al-Khattab, Mughiriya and so on. This is known as ghuluv. To elevate somebody to a status above what is supposed to be their actual status. We have many kinds of reports on ghuluv. And the imams always used to tell the people, keep away from these guys. And the imam used to get angry with them. And he would really, really get angry. And sometimes we have anecdotes where the imam also sends curses. It's very rare for the imam to give la'an. But he would get so angry at people who would elevate him to a status of supernatural status, which is not his actual status, ghuluv. Imam Hussein, you know, if you elevate him, if we elevate him to semi-divine, of course, we do a disservice to Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein does not need us to elevate him to deity, to godhood. Imam Hussein's behavior itself is exemplar. He doesn't need no help from us, believe me. He doesn't need help from a preacher to elevate him to godhood, to make this all this fada'il for him. He needs no help. Imam Hussein in his own originality is himself a miracle. And if I have to pump him up and exaggerate, that means I'm doing a disservice to him and a disservice to his message, believe me. Ghuluf. You make Imam Hussein as a super deity, that means he has no relevance for me. Imam Hussein is somebody out there as a semi-divine, but he has no exemplary value for me, no lessons for me. So I remember Imam Hussein for salvation. Oh, Imam Hussein, help me to receive Jannah. Oh, Fatimatul Zahra, give me Shafa'a. If we use Imam Hussein as a miracle doer, you devalue him. This is known as ghuluf. And the book covers this, Ayatollah covers this very, very well. You know, if you read this book, you know, I think you will go to paradise. Jannah is yours. How do I know? Of course I don't know. But anyways, you ought to buy the book and read the book. Not just buy, but read the book. Read the book, and it's very, very cheap. It's how much is it? It's $10. How much is $10? In American dollars. How many? How many pounds would that be? 6-7 pounds. Okay, I'll give you a discount. £6. How's that? Okay. I think you ought to certainly read the book. This is the ghuluv. We have another kind of what we call extremism. Exaggeration is ghuluv. Extremism is when you take things either in excess or you fall short. For example, we have a tradition of Imam Ali. He says, "Halaka fiya rajulan, muhibbun ghalin wa mubghidun qal." Two kinds of people will destroy themselves, will perish. Who are those two kinds of people? Those who love me in excess, and they do ifrat. They go on the extreme, one extreme, of over-loving me and exaggerating about my virtues. And then there's also another group, known as tafrit, that falls short of standing beside Imam Ali. This is equally a problem. Both the polarization, both the extremes, ifrat or tafrit, deficiency, are both known as extremism. That also can do a disservice to the Karbala episode. And ta'assub, fanaticism, in Arabic, ta'assub. Ta'assub means bigotry, prejudice. That is to say that my understanding, and only my understanding, is true, and everybody else will go to hellfire. I'm prejudiced. I have bigotry, known as ta'assub, fanaticism. Okay. And you have many examples. I can give you many, many examples. But let me give you an example of ifrat or tafrit, extremism. There are people who will say that, you know, I must do the masa'ib by using the sword, kamezadan, right? Although it is harmful to them. And harming yourself is un-Quranic. But if you tell them, they don't accept. They say, no, this is my way of showing love. But it is on the extremities. This is what the Imam is asking for. And then there'll be others on the other extreme who will say, what? Why do you guys weep for somebody who died more than 13 centuries ago? Don't you guys have better things to do in life? That's the other extreme of ifrat, tafrit. We are trying to seek the point of balance. Equilibrium, al-wasat, says the Quran. That is the point of being at the point of median. Those who mock azadari, I think they are on the wrong course. Those who excessively decorate and exaggerate azadari as if it's a point of salvation, that they can cheat, they can lie, they can deceive, they can defame, they can slander, they can gossip, they can do everything in life, just they must do azadari, and then Jannah is theirs, Behesht is theirs. That's the other extreme. And I had a friend who would, I had a friend who would carry a passport to heaven. I tell you, I asked him, you know, why do you carry this passport to heaven always in your pocket? Are you so sure? Let me see inside your passport. And you know, I saw inside the passport there was a multiple entry visa to paradise. And I said, well, I thought paradise is one way, salvation is one way. Inshallah wa ta'ala, when all of us enter paradise, there is no exit. It's one way entry, single entry visa. He said, no, you don't understand. I need multiple entry visa because some of my friends will be in hellfire. I need to visit them once in a while and re-enter. So sure. He's absolutely sure about himself that he is going to paradise. This is known as arrogance. It's known as kibr, right? In any event, examples of ifrat and tafrit. Many other examples we can give you, but I think this will suffice for now. Salawat. Now, I'm almost, my time has ended. No, I have till 9:35, no, 8:35 to 9:15, right? So my time is literally up. Isn't it true? Well, you won't go to paradise now. It's over, I changed my mind. If you were to give me more minutes, you know, I might have let you go to paradise. But in any event, this is the introduction, is that our emphasis is going to be how to understand our religion, both ibadat and mu'amalat. How to understand the acts of worship and the acts of mu'amalat that has to do with interhuman transactions. How to find this, to do both these things in Islam, but not to be exaggerated, not to be extremist, not to be fanatics. How can we find that at point of al-wasat? In both ibadat and mu'amalat. We can become fanatics also in ibadat. We can become fanatics also in our mu'amalat. Both. You know, for example, examples of mu'amalat. Do you have examples of mu'amalat? Give me an example of mu'amalat. For example, Muslim, non-Muslim relationship. For example. Another example of mu'amalat. Many examples. Anything that we do as a human transaction. How can we find this point of balance, inshallah wa ta'ala, and not to be either on ifrat nor on tafrid? Salawat. Tomorrow, inshallah, as well, I'll talk about the, you know, in Shi'ism, we are blessed with the centrality of intellect, al-aql. It's very phenomenal, you know. Islam is a, Shiism especially is a religion of rationality. I can't imagine in Shiism you could ever have a phenomenon of Wahhabism. Wahhabism I don't think can ever happen within Shiism because of the element of intellect, al-aql. You know, if the Akhbari school had become successful, maybe. But since the Usuli school became successful, it is not feasible to have a phenomenon of what we have today in the Wahhabi culture of uniformity. They don't want us to think. Wahhabi culture wants to rob us of our thinking power, of intellect. You know, and that's the biggest threat that we have and the biggest disease, that we should always be careful. Nobody should brainwash you, neither from here, nor from the member, nor from university. You should be able to think yourself, right? All of us have brain power, inshallah wa ta'ala, I'm sure. Okay, let's have some questions. And just dialogue as well, you can comments as well. Oh, the question is, what is the Akhbari and the Usuli? Very briefly, it happened during the Qajar period in Iran in the 16th, 17th century. There were two schools of thought. One school of thought believed that the hadith are enough for us and we should read the hadith literally. There is no element of deduction, there is no element of human engagement. Whatever we read in the Quran, we read as a literal word of God. There is no what we call hermeneutics, there is no process of engagement, there is no ijtihad. There is no ijtihad. Usuli school believe whatever we have is enough. We have the hadith, we should believe in all of them as true. None of them are false. This is very similar to Ahl Hadith in the Sunni school of dogma, that the hadith is enough. Then we have another school of law, thought, that succeeded, known as the Usuliyun. Usuliyun believe that no, the hadith are there, the Quran is there, but there's also a role to be played by human reason. Human reason is also required to be able to understand the Quran. You require something to facilitate your reading of the Quran. You need something as a medium. There is no such thing as, you know, it's impossible today, we say in the theory, that somebody gives you a book, a text, and you say, okay, this is the way it is. A text always goes through a process of filtration. There is no text without a context. It's impossible to read a text without engaging a medium of intellect. And this is the bias. This is the bias. So I have a bias when I read the Quran. All of us have a bias. But the idea is to be as objective as possible. But the Usuli school succeeded. And this is the school that allows for ijtihad. Otherwise we would have no mujtahids, by the way. There would be no mujtahids at all if the Akhbari school had succeeded.
Okay, we have the mics in the ladies' side as well.
Okay. So
can we... if there is any question or comment from the ladies' side, then can we go ahead, please?
Assalamualaikum.
Alaikum salam.
I take slight issue with the interpretation that you gave of Major Hassan. I feel like we're taking the same mentality as kind of the Western world or others as how others perceive us.
Okay.
And in some senses, we're basically with when it comes to Muslims and Muslims committing crimes and acts of terror. We're taking this kind of mentality of guilty until proven innocent. Whereas, I mean, like, Columbines happen in the US all the time.
Right, right.
And, I mean, I don't feel like people tend to look at the kind of religious identity of the people that commit these crimes. And when it comes to Muslims, the first thing that's kind of picked up on is the fact that this guy was a Muslim. He was of Middle Eastern origin. And I feel like we're just ascribing to the same mentality. So if you could comment on that.
Good point. I mean, this is beautiful. This is exactly, you know, we want to have engagement. You know, if everybody agrees, then we have a boring uniform session. I think this is good. And the ladies started the pattern. So let's, you know, yes, a good point. You know, you're lucky I'm not Maulana. You know, if I had Maulana sometimes get upset. You know, I was in a program, you won't believe, and actually overseas, and we had some very heated discussion. And one of the scholars got quite upset with the debate. He took out his imamah and threw it against the guy who was questioning him. So I have none, by the way. So, in any event, I think you are right to an extent. I do agree with you that the media has certainly stereotyped any kind of violence with our religion. That Islam and violence are almost synonymous. They go hand in hand. So anything that is done wrong by a Muslim gets attributed to its religion. Whereas if a crime is committed by other, people of other religions, you don't associate religion with them. Likewise, in a secular culture, the kind of things that we have done, we have created havoc in the world. You know, in the name of, fighting terrorism. And we have created mess. But we don't say, okay, this was the problem of United Kingdom. You guys, UK and America, I don't know, so and so and so. We kind of separate these two. Okay? But unfortunately, the way the media has always, I think, portrayed Islam and Muslims has been in a very negative fashion, partly because I think we have limited presence in the media outlets. I know here you have some good papers. I know there is this Muslim news that is being circulated here, right? But overall, I think we are minuscule in comparison, We don't have any presence also in the academy. In the universities, how many professors do you think, Muslim professors teach Islam? Of course, if you educate people, you mentor them and you give them wrong stuff, this is what they learn. So we need to have presence also in the academy, in the media, in film documentary, and so on. And we are learning slowly. But I don't see when Major Hassan himself says that I'm doing this on behalf of Islam. You see, he did not say, for example, I'm doing this in the name of Iraqis, or because you are killing, innocent civilians. He himself associates with his mission to be a religious mission. You see what I'm saying?
Can I just gain some clarification? When I read the articles in the British media,
right. There
was no mention of him ever referring to any kind of religious affiliation that he had.
Major Hassan?
Yeah.
Oh, he was a Muslim,
sure. But he never actually claimed that he was doing what he was committing, whatever he was committing in the name of religion.
So, right.
I don't know how we are ascribing these things to him.
The reason is that several evidence. One evidence is he gave if you saw his presentation that he gave to his colleagues, it's a PowerPoint presentation on which he talks about his Muslim identity. He talks about this, that he is rooted in the Islamic, he's anchored there in the Islamic tradition. And you see the anger that he feels. Why do you think he's so angry? It's not he's just a psychopath. He was angry because he feels that Muslims are being killed, Muslims are being tortured, their rights are being violated. And this is why his anger came within a context of being a Muslim. Why do you think he was wearing, shalwar kameez? A shalwar kameez is not worn by somebody who's a secularist. It's an identity. What we do, what we wear, the way we speak, the kind of language we speak, it reflects our identity of who I believe I ought to be and I am. You see? And therefore, everything that we see about Major Hassan, he used to go for Friday prayers, he used to go and meet so and so. We have all these anecdotes about him that he himself identified as being a believing Muslim. And if he himself claims to be a Muslim, and we have reports, I didn't hear, we have reports that before he began the shooting rampage, he said, Allahu Akbar. Okay? Now, I wasn't there, but there were many independent people who were there who said that he said, Allahu Akbar. Now, imagine, if he said so, he is associating. You can say, this is not Islam. Yes, I agree with you. This is not Islam, of course. But certainly, he has taken some of this belief system from the Islamic literature. Somebody has brainwashed him. He was in contact with the Sheikh in Yemen, seeking guidance. It shows he's a believer. Why would an Arab wear a shalwar kameez? So yes, you are right that, like I said, we don't need to apologize for him. I need no apology. It's an act of criminality. It's an act that actually hijacks our religion of Islam. It's an act that harms our faith. So we apologize to nobody. What I do say is that we need to tackle, we should say, he doesn't belong to that tradition. His acts don't belong to the tradition. And The literature that inspires hate doesn't belong to us. And we have lots of literature, Sunni and Shia, juridical literature, that preaches hate, that talks about conquering, expansionist, that talks about, you know, forcing people to convert to Islam or to kill them. We have literature, not the Quran. You see? So when we have this kind of literature, we need to say, well, we don't agree with this, throw it away. But as far as Major Hassan is concerned, would you say he regarded himself as a non-Muslim?
I wouldn't say he regarded himself as a non-Muslim. I don't necessarily think that the fact that he went to Friday prayers or that he wore a shawl kameez or he identified right. with something necessarily means that that's what motivated him to commit the crimes. Having said that, if he did, you know, mention Allahu Akbar before
right.
he carried out his crime, that might be an indication. I just never read that in the papers, but I'm not sure if that was
Allahu Akbar and his presentation. You know, he gave several presentations to the soldiers and the academy there, the military academy, and you can see very clearly in his presentations that he talks about that the war against terror, he said, America is your war against Islam. So he clearly associates, you know, what America was doing and is doing, let's say, or United Kingdom, as a war by the Crusaders against Islam. I have no doubt in my mind. Therefore, you know, some people were saying, no, you know, his fuse just went off. He was a psychopath. No, I don't think he was a psychopath. It was a premeditated, it was a strategic, deliberate, you know, engaged, you know, loss of life. For example, he emptied his apartment. He knew what he was doing. He went and bought those guns. He knew what he was doing. You know, it's not to say, well, he was just a crazy guy who was irrational. No, I think he used some of this hate literature in Islam, and then he was brainwashed by this, probably with the Wahhabi ideology, and then some of these Wahhabi mentors, and this led to this phenomena of killing. There's no justification at all. Don't you agree? I mean, there's no justification. And this is one example. Okay? I can give you other examples. The kinds of things that are happening, let's say, where Muslims throw grenades in mosques. We know they are Muslims. How dare? How dare? You know? Or the kind of... I'm not saying that this is... that, you know, they are just doing this for no reason. Yes, I know they are in pain. The Muslims are going through a period of hopelessness, a period of despair. You know, there's a lot of pain. But even then, for the Saudi Mufti, for example, you know, to say that the Shias, their blood is valid, is jais, what do you think? You think he's not a Muslim? Saudi sheikhs, Muftis, they're giving fatwas and rulings that the Shias are murtad, apostates, and therefore shedding their blood is lawful. You don't think they believe they are the best Muslims? Of course, they are mufti. They can give fatwa. Now, how can I possibly justify and say, no, I cannot criticize him? Yes, you know, I mean, he is doing this in the name of Islam, and he believes that this is it. I mean, the Sheikh of the Mecca right now, the Kaaba, when he came to power, Sheikh Kalbani, one of the first ruling he gave was that the Shias, because they condemn the Sahaba, they are unbelievers, they are murtad. You know, simple as that. You know, so this I find very troubling, you know, when people take Islam and they start giving fatwas, you know, that I can do this and this, and we have no right at all. And that's why I say the Muharram should be used as a forum. You see what has happened, partly the Wahhabi culture is a reaction to what we have done. It's partly a reaction to, you know, the Sunni bashing that we have done. For years and years and years, we used to give lan, right? And curses upon the caliph and Ummul Mu'min. Don't we? Isn't it true? We still do it in some place, don't we? Curse upon this and this. I've been to Iran in majalis, you know, lanat upon so and so from the mimbar. And I'll show you a video. What kind of vulgarity, what kind of venomous language they use when they talk of. You don't talk like this against any human being. Imam Ali told his people when they were denouncing the companions of Muawiyah in the Battle of Siffin, Imam said, no, don't do sab. You can't do this. You can't go around denouncing and condemning and vilifying your enemies. These are Muawiyah's people. They want to kill Imam Ali. He says, you can't do this. He says, rather, I prefer that you talk about their attributes, their characteristics. Talk about the character. That the character is bad. Their behavior is bad. But don't insult the humanity of the human being. Humanity of the human being is worthy of respect. Now we have this phenomena of going on using the Muharram to create this sectarian hatred. You know? So we do this in all the places, and then the Sunnis, of course, they hear this. For them, the Khulafa are, for them, they are sacred. Isn't it true? So they have to then somehow react. If you denounce Aisha, okay, imagine somebody would denounce, God forbid, Fatima al-Zahra. You'll get upset and you will retaliate. So it has been this reciprocal match of mutual condemnation that has led to this. You know, and that's exactly what Sheikh Albani said. Sheikh Albani said, because you guys preach hatred against our Khulafa, our Ummul Mu'mineen, therefore we regard you as unbelievers. You know, so we have gone back and forth. Okay, and I'll show you videos. You know, I was going to show you today, but inshallah, you know, if we have time tomorrow, a video of how we talk about the Ahlul Sunnah wal Jama'ah, you know, and the language that we use, brothers and sisters, is so vulgar, it's so venomous, that we are almost creating the culture of reaction against us. It's very, very problematic, you know. Of course, the Wahhabis don't have a right to kill us either. Of course, of course. But I'm saying that we should not give them any ammunition, you know, to create this culture of hate against us, you know. Why do you think Iraq went like this, you know? Some of the MSAs, if you are Shia, they can't tolerate you, right? Isn't it true? Those who are in universities. If you are part of the MSA group and you are a Shia, they make life sometimes so difficult. I don't know here, I'm talking about some of the American university campuses. You know, some of the American mosques, if they are funded by the Saudi petrodollars and you are a Shia, you're not welcome. The khutbahs that they give are so empty, full of poison, you know, because they are supported by this petro money and the Wahhabi ideology. You know, we have to bring an end, you know, somebody has to start a process of healing, you know. Both sides have done, you know, have hurt each other. And now it is time to start healing. And that's why I say Imam Hussein is all but love. Is everything, everything and love. You know? And if we can reenact this culture of love, then we can start to heal. We have many, many, many wounds that have been inflicted by others. And also we have inflicted some of the wounds ourselves. Self-inflicted wounds as well. We have both. You know? And therefore I think we really need islah. We need healing. We need healing. And the only healing that can come is by language of love, language of understanding, of mutual respect, a culture of disagreement. We need to create ethics of disagreement. For example, if I disagree with you, it should not generate hate. Okay, if I disagree with you, that's fine. I disagree with my Sunni brothers and sisters, that's fine. And they can disagree with me. But it should not generate this sense of hatred, you know. Even within our Shia, let's say if I disagree with you, it's over. We say, okay, no, it's finished now, finito. Right? You go to a mosque and you give a lecture that, you know, some people who are the executive don't like what they heard. Never invite this guy. A very close-minded mentality. You can disagree with everybody. The whole idea is you bring people who are different-minded to enhance literacy. You know, when we hire in the universities, in the search committee, we look for people who disagree with us to hire them. Because you want to have a spectrum of opinions. You want to have diversity of opinions. You don't want to have somebody who agrees with you in your methodology, in your theory. The whole idea is you want to create enhancement in the student body. So you look for those who disagree with you. So Islamic centers, in my view, should look for different opinions. And the whole idea is that when you listen to different opinions, This is where you become very nuanced, you become sophisticated. You begin to understand the various pros and cons. If I only give my views, of course you will agree with me because I'm giving you the best side of my theory. Bring somebody who disagrees with me, and they will give you the best argument that they have to refute me, to reject me. Well, of course, now you have both sides of the agreement, of the debate, you know. So I think this is a phenomenon, partly, you know, that has also been happening, is that in Islamic centers, you know, we are very literate professionally, I think. We are, you know, in medicine, in engineering, in computers, and nobody goes into religion, by the way. I was just asking Kumail, why don't you go into religion, by the way? What is medicine got to do with you? You know, we need bright minds to go into religion, brilliant minds to go into religion. We don't want to have people who are substandard. When they have nothing better to do in life, they say, okay, I'll go to religion. That's not the kind of caliber we want the best. Isn't it true? Just like in medicine, you want the best. You want to have the best of things in your house. We want to have the best of things for Islam. Especially in this era. In this era of demonization of Islam, you must have the best people to articulate about your religion. And yet we don't have such spokespeople, you know. Universities have many, many, many positions open. But we don't have people to fill them, Muslims to fill them. I think partly because I think we create a culture of uniformity. I think we need to respect diversity. That even if we disagree, I think it is natural. Disagreement is part and parcel of being human. You know, in the Sunni literature hadith, it's a Sunni hadith, they actually praise ikhtilaf. There's a hadith, many hadiths like this, that say ikhtilaf al-ulama rahma, that disagreements amongst the scholars is a sign of divine mercy. Okay? This is a Sunni hadith, so, I mean, don't say, okay, you know, Mavani said so. I'm telling you, this is not a Shia hadith, but there's something to learn as well. You know, disagreements is not the end of the world. I'll try to be brief. Yeah, sorry.
I think we have to stop here with the question and answer because we're over on the time. If you have if you want to continue with the history of Karbala or from tomorrow or today, it's up to you.
You mean there's some time allocated for the history as well?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure, so yeah, okay, sure. I mean, just the Karbala episode, right?
No, I don't know how the time is allocated to you by the committee.
I thought my time was up to, was it 9:15 and then 15 minute question answer?
Okay.
So I think I've exceeded my time, right? tomorrow.
Inshallah. Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad Salwad.
Inshallah, tomorrow I'll... But if I also talk about Karbala, then I think 45 minutes will be, you know. So you talk about Karbala, I will talk a few things as well, inshallah. You know, he did a very good job, by the way, very good job. Thank you very much for your patience. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.